Hello, this is Ms. Dell with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated Monday, June 1st, 2026. We will begin today's reading on the front page with an article headlined, Data Center Bill Won't Advance This Spring. As measure falters, sponsors call for halting tax credit. Conversations about the Power Act, a multifaceted data center regulation bill, are not over yet, but those involved say the bill wasn't expected to be ready by the General Assembly's Sunday, May 31st deadline. That means pending data center projects will not be subject to guardrails proposed in the bill, such as water use reporting, community benefits agreements, and requirements that data centers pay for their own energy from renewable sources. Representative Carol Ammons, Democrat Urbana, the chair of the House Energy and Environment Committee and a sponsor of the bill, said at a Tuesday hearing that at least one more subject matter hearing is needed so lawmakers can hear from additional stakeholders. We're just going to finish out this session, she said after a House subject matter hearing. We'll work with staff and our stakeholders and put something else on the books over the summer. She said she doesn't know when the bill might be considered in the future, but it could come up in the fall veto session later this year after negotiations continue through the summer. On Wednesday, the Illinois Clean Jobs Coalition, a collection of environmental advocacy organizations, businesses, and groups, called for quick action. The ICJC supports continued education about the Power Act, but communities around the states have spoken and are demanding action from lawmakers to address the impact the influx of data centers has on our utility bills, water resources, and communities, said Hannah Flath, a spokesperson for the Illinois Environmental Council, on behalf of the Clean Jobs Coalition. We're calling on legislative leaders to convene a negotiating table by the end of June to negotiate and work towards passing the Power Act. House Majority Leader Robin Gabel, a Democrat from Evanston, who has led the bill in the House, said at a Saturday rally hosted by the ICJC that there's another option for regulating data centers while negotiations continue. The governor proposed a pause in the data center tax credit in his budget address, and we need to get that done in this year's budget, Gabel said. The last thing we should be doing is handing out tax breaks and incentives to these profitable corporations. Since 2019, Illinois has incentivized data center developers to come to the state by offering tax credits, but Governor J.B. Pritzker proposed suspending those in February. According to the state's 2024 report, at least 27 data centers have received incentives totaling $983 million in estimated lifetime tax breaks and benefits. With the shifting energy landscape, it is imperative that our growth does not undermine affordability and stability for our families, Pritzker said at the time. Since then, he's continued to call for regulations, particularly for data centers, to pay their own energy generation and to source it from renewables. But advocates have lamented the governor's lack of engagement on the issue throughout the legislative session, outside of a few public statements. A group of lawmakers from both chambers sent a letter to House and Senate leadership on Friday calling for a tax credit pause. We believe the responsible course of action is to pause the data center tax credits and exemptions in the FY 2027 budget until common sense guardrails are in place, they wrote in the letter obtained by Capital News Illinois. It is not only fiscally irresponsible, but also unconscionable to continue to provide millions of taxpayer dollars to big tech corporations harming our climate, straining our grid, and making electric bills unaffordable for working families. Gabel said the House is ready to move forward with continued negotiations and there are signs of bipartisan support. The House version of the Power Act has been subject to four hearings since it was introduced in February. Those have involved testimony from a variety of stakeholders, from local leaders to utilities and environmental advocates. Because the bill regulates a rapidly growing and changing industry, lawmakers have wanted to ensure regulations are targeted correctly. During the hearings, they've heard about the massive demand data centers put on the grid, risks posed to water sources, and impacts on communities. They also heard warnings that onerous regulations might lead to developers pulling their projects from Illinois, meaning communities could miss out on property and utility tax benefits. The Power Act requires data center companies to pay for their own energy generation and for the energy to come from renewable sources such as solar, wind, and battery storage. The bill would also require data center projects to track and report how much water they use and to submit water management plans to the Illinois Water Survey, a nonprofit, non-government research group connected to the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. Another provision would require more transparency about data center development and for data center developers to sign community benefit agreements in the places they're constructed. On Saturday, the Illinois Clean Jobs Coalition held a rally with Gable and Senator Ram Villavallum, Democrat Chicago, the lawmaker leading the Senate version of the bill. This is, as has been mentioned, the most comprehensive data center legislation in the nation, Villavallum said. This is a big bill for a big problem, but big bills and big solutions take a lot of work. He called for rally attendees to continue reaching out to their lawmakers and to use Saturday as an opportunity to talk to them in person. The protections in the Power Act are the guardrails and common sense guardrails we need to protect ratepayers, communities, and our natural resources, Villavallum said. The impacts of the data centers are too big to ignore. We're going to keep fighting for transparency. We're going to keep fighting for fairness. We're going to keep fighting to hold big tech accountable. Advocates from around Illinois also spoke about the need for the bill. Data centers are coming, the Reverend Darnell Tingle of United Congregations of Metro East said. They're being proposed, they are being negotiated, and they're being approved. And too many communities are being forced to respond one city at a time, one village at a time, one zone meeting at a time. He said communities of color are too often forced to deal with the downsides of industrial growth, and the Power Act is a measure to protect those communities. We need statewide standards. We need statewide guardrails. We need statewide accountability, he said. Yes, we need protection that covers all of Illinois, not just the communities with the most money, not just the towns with the most lawyers, not just the places with the most political access, but everybody. Our next front page article, Rare Portrait of Lincoln Crosses Us, painting gifted to Roosevelt Library in North Dakota, once hung in White House. There was something intriguing about the oil painting of Abraham Lincoln hanging on David Soderquist's home office wall in New York. It features a three-quarter profile of a clean-shaven Lincoln dressed in formal attire, surrounded by cabinets and shelves full of books about ships and art. Soderquist would sit at his desk, stare at the painting, and wonder, why did it speak to him? Who owned it before? The artist and former financial advisor wasn't the first to admire the painting of a beardless, well-dressed Lincoln. After years of digging, the answers Soderquist found mean many other Americans will get the chance to admire the picture at the new Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library in Medora, North Dakota. The library is set to open on July 4th, the nation's 250th birthday. This is the story of a gift-giving Soderquist hopes will continue. The story is part of an ongoing series exploring the 250th anniversary of the United States in 2026. Visit our website to read other stories in the series and share your own. In 2021, Soderquist's aunt downsized after the death of her husband. She gave Soderquist and his brother John a collection of paintings and antiques. Soderquist stood in the garage as his brother retrieved the Lincoln portrait from the attic. "I just saw it lowering down like it was coming out of the heavens. I thought, wow," Soderquist recalled. He immediately asked his brother if he could keep it. John said yes, with one caveat. They would split the proceeds if the painting were ever sold. Soderquist is a lifelong fan of Lincoln's resilience and faith. In his youth, he wrote inspirational quotes and drew stars on the late president's portraits. To me, he emulated everything that would want to be as a human being, Soderquist told USA Today. The brown and gold framed piece soon found a home in his office. Starting in 2021, Soderquist began researching the painting's origin. The signature in the upper left-hand corner confirmed the artist was the American realist Ernest Wells. The date alongside showed it was based on a photo of Lincoln used in his presidential campaign. Soderquist dropped the effort when he hit roadblocks, only to return over and over. Wells wasn't a prominent artist, art historians told him, and the piece wasn't worth much because it was a painting of a picture rather than a portrait for which Lincoln sat. One auction house told Soderquist he could sell the painting for $700 at most. He couldn't let it go. As I kept looking at it, something fired in my brain, and I just said, "I want to really bear down and find out exactly what the deal is here," he said. On September 2025, Soderquist resumed investigating. An intriguing note glued to the back of the painting mentioned it was purchased from one of Lincoln's personal bodyguards. Soderquist believes the note was typed by Bella DaCosta Green, J.P. Morgan's personal librarian. It documented the portrait's sale from Colonel William H. Crook to Morgan on January 5, 1912. As Soderquist dug, the story slowly came together. He connected with the art historian and chief curator at the Morgan Library and Museum in New York City. The historian found documentation of the sale that included letters from the White House confirming the painting hung there for 6 years. Wells gifted his painting to President Theodore Roosevelt in 1903, 4 years after completing it. Roosevelt, a well-known admirer of Lincoln, promptly hung it in his White House office and wrote a letter of thanks to Wells that Wells carried for years. Photos from the time show the painting hung opposite Roosevelt's desk, the only picture on the green wall. Roosevelt spoke of looking to Lincoln's example when faced with difficult decisions. Accounts from aides and cabinet officers state he would often turn the painting and ask aloud, "What would Lincoln do?" When he left the White House in March 1909, Roosevelt gifted the canvas to Crook, his chief dispersing officer. In 1912, Crook sold it for $300 to Morgan. The banker's librarian, DaCosta Green, managed the sale. When Morgan died the next year, most of his vast collection went to American museums, but the Wells painting was sold. Soderquist's family purchased it at auction in 1975. Soderquist said art museums across the United States turned down his offer to loan the painting. The fact that it hung in the White House for so long and was cherished by Roosevelt is where its value lies, he said. He said he was struck by the scope of the decisions Roosevelt made with the portrait in the room, from the creation of the Panama Canal to adding millions of acres to the national park system. When Soderquist reached out to the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library for help authenticating the piece, the curator was interested in borrowing it. He said, "It will be on public display when the museum opens on Independence Day. The exhibit will feature it just as it appeared in Roosevelt's office. Visitors will be able to interact with an AI version of the former president who can answer questions about the painting meant to him. He cites Lincoln in several of his speeches, and I think he looks to the guidance of a man who kept the country together in a very difficult time, library spokesman Matt Brinney said. It isn't uncommon for pieces of American history to land in private hands, but a find like this is unusual, Brinney said. There's just a remarkable story about the lineage of this object, he said. Those are the finds that curators love for the province, and it's just very rare to ever have. Our last front page article, teams compete in quarter-scale tractor competition. College students get engine, then design and build their own machine. Logan Turgason helped build a tractor. Specifically, he and his friends from South Dakota State University built a tractor named Shelby from the ground up. Then they brought it to Bloomington to test it against 22 other teams in the 29th Annual International Quarter-Scale Tractor Student Design Competition hosted by the American Society of Agricultural and Biological Engineers at the McLean County Fairgrounds in Bloomington. There's always something that, you know, we get to competition, we think our tractor is perfect or as close to perfect as we can be, and there's always something that comes up that leads to a late night or two while we're here, and fixing that so we can continue competing, Turgidson said Saturday. He and fellow tractor pilot Brock Hansen graduated this year with degrees in agricultural biological systems engineering. There are several factors to the competition, including team presentation and design and performance judging. The latter includes a maneuverability course, a series of tractor pulls, and a durability course that requires the teams to pull a 4,000-pound load over a small hill and speed bumps. We do occasionally have tractors that break on this, said Josh Medeiros, co-chairman of the competition committee. That's part of the design of our track. It's to test the durability of your tractor. So if you've built a tractor that can withstand 20 minutes going through the course, then you've done a good job and you've designed your tractor and manufactured it in a durable way. The point is to give college students studying engineering a foot in the door, as it were, hands-on experience of creating and testing a real product while still studying, he said. They're learning the design factor of it, the actual manufacturing of the tractors, and then, coming here, they're learning how to sell the tractor during a presentation in front of a panel of industry experts, Medeiros said. And, as with many competitions, there are cash prizes. First place takes home $1,500, incrementally down through fifth place receiving $500. But it's the exposure to the sponsors and the industry that is most rewarding, Medeiros said. The competition started on Thursday and wrapped up Sunday. For the competition, teams received a 34.5 horsepower Kawasaki engine, a quarter-scale version of what is used in farm equipment, and a set of Titan tires, Medeiros said, and that's it. From there, they build everything else. They build the frame, drivetrain, steering, everything, suspension, he said. And the students make all the decisions. Shelby, which Turgason and Hansen piloted on Saturday, used the engine to drive a series of hydraulic pumps, said teammate Logan Bachman, a freshman studying mechanical engineering, whom his teammates affectionately call Timmy Tough Knuckles. We made and designed our own circuit boards, he said, so all of the code inside of our tractor is our own code. We wrote the code with, you know, assistance from other students, and then we also have two hydraulic drivetrains, kind of like how a skid steer works. Instead of the gasoline engine powering a physical drivetrain, the hydraulic motors transfer fluid pressure to wheel motion, said Joseph Moore, a junior studying agricultural systems technology. It pumps the oil, and that goes through hoses and a control valve, and that goes through two hydraulic motors, he explained, and that takes the fluid power from the liquid and turns it into motion. That is what drives the wheels. At peak speed, it could produce 2,400 foot-pounds of torque, said Danny Hetchler, who graduated with a degree in precision agriculture. I don't think we've ever been able to fully test that because we spin out, he said. This was the competition's first time in Bloomington, Madero said. Previously, they were in Peoria for over a decade, but they plan on returning to the Twin Cities next year because McLean County Fairgrounds provides us with everything that we need, and that's a lot better than our previous location, he said. It usually runs from Thursday to Sunday and is free to the public, Madero said, for those interested in watching students from around the country test their creations. The competition is unique because it gives them a chance to experiment in their field while learning the theory, Turgenson said. The biggest thing for me is seeing the things that we learn in the classroom or are currently learning in the classroom immediately turn around and be applied to this, he said, motioning to the tractor. We're learning from this project things you would otherwise learn working on actual projects in the workplace, Moore said. But we're sort of jump-starting it because we're still in school, so we're getting experience with technologies and equipment that we would otherwise have no experience with. That's the whole point of the competition, Madero said. We just want the students to do the best they can. We don't want them to quit, you know. If you break your tractor, we want you to go back to your pit area and fix it, you know. Overcome the problems. Our next article, Decatur Fire Department body pulled from house fire. Detectives investigating death. Detectives have been called in to investigate after a body was found in the ashes of a fire that engulfed a Decatur home Saturday morning. The Decatur Fire Department statement, released through the office of Deputy Decatur Police Chief Scott Rosenberry, in charge of criminal investigations, said fire crews had been alerted to the fire at 468 South Boyd Street at 7:40 a.m. after receiving multiple 911 calls. First arriving units found significant fire and heavy smoke emanating from the single-family residence, Rosenberry said. Crews immediately began fire suppression and search operations, quickly bringing the fire under control. During their efforts, fire crews located one victim within the home. Unfortunately, the civilian victim was determined to be deceased. Rosenberry said the fire is now being investigated by the detectives. Experts from the Decatur Fire Department, the Office of the State Fire Marshal, and State Police Crime Scene Services. Anyone with information is encouraged to contact the Decatur Police Department's Criminal Investigation Division at 217-424-2734 or Crime Stoppers at 217-423-8477, Rosenberry said. Our next article, Permit Processing Delays Strain DACA Recipients. After their work permits expired, an immigration attorney near San Diego was fired and a nurse in California's East Bay area was placed on unpaid leave. Both depend on work permits and legal protection afforded under Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, a program created by President Barack Obama in 2012 for immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children. But recent processing delays at U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services are leaving many DACA recipients vulnerable to arrest and deportation as their two-year work permits expire. It's definitely an attack on the program, said the lawyer Maria Fernanda Madrigal. My first thought was, oh, they're so clever. They weren't able to end the program through the courts, so this is what they're doing. Over the past several years, median processing times for the DACA renewals were under 2 months. Now most cases are finished within 3 to 5 months, according to Citizenship and Immigration Services. The agency did not explain what's causing the processing delays. Spokesperson Zach Collar wrote in a statement that under the leadership of President Trump's USCIS is safeguarding the American people by more thoroughly screening and vetting all aliens. DACA does not confer any form of legal status in this country, he said. During his first term in office, Trump tried unsuccessfully to rescind DACA. This time around, his administration has simply weakened its benefits. Last year, Department of Homeland Security officials started urging DACA recipients to self-deport. The Department of Health and Human Services made DACA recipients ineligible for health insurance through Obamacare. And last month, a precedent-setting decision from the Board of Immigration Appeals, which will apply to immigration judges across the country, said having DACA is not enough to protect someone from deportation. A Department of Homeland Security spokesman said, ICE arrested 650 DACA recipients between January 20, 2025 and April 30, nearly 90% of whom were not charged with or convicted of a crime. The spokesperson did not say how many were deported. But in a February letter to U.S. Senators, then Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem said the agency deported 86 DACA recipients between January 1st and November 19, 2025. Federal judges have ordered the agency to return some, including Maria de Jesus Estrada Juarez, a Sacramento mother who was deported the day after her green card interview. Lawmakers are expressing alarm that DACA's promise of protection is being undermined. Last month, Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee held a forum on the Trump administration's all-out assault on DACA. The forum featured Santa Ana Police Chief Robert Rodriguez, who testified that he was forced to fire a police officer because their work permit renewal was not processed on time. Last week, members of the House of California's Central Valley, including Representative David Velado, Republican, Hanford, sent a letter to Homeland Security and Citizenship and Immigration Service leaders, urging them to expedite DACA processing. Our offices have seen a substantial increase in constituent cases involving pending renewals, with many remaining unsolved for more than 6 months, the letter continued. These extended processing times are creating avoidable hardships for our communities and our economy. California has more than a quarter of the nation's approximately 500,000 DACA recipients, according to the Citizenship and Immigration Services figures. On average, they are 31 years old. To qualify for DACA, occupants had to pass background checks and meet certain educational or work requirements. During a news conference ahead of the DACA forum last month, Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat, Illinois, reflected on the day in June 2012, when DACA applications first opened. He said parents of young immigrants asked him if it was safe for their children to sign up for the program, which required admitting their lack of legal status and home address. "Are you sure that the government won't use that information against us at some time?" he remembered them asking. I said, "Follow the law exactly as it's written and announced in the executive order, and we'll stand by you. Just believe in us to do that." Well, I didn't anticipate the current president and what he is now doing, Durbin continued. Sarah Krieger, a former Citizenship and Immigration Services official who is now senior policy counsel at the National Immigration Law Center, said processing delays were caused in part by the agency temporarily pausing an automated system for processing DACA and other applications. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, dated Monday, June 1st, 2026. Please stay tuned.